Hey everybody, it's Mike Jeffers, ChicagoJazz.com, Chicago Jazz Magazine, and welcome to a Throwback Thursday podcast here on the Chicago Jazz Audio Experience. We're going to go back to 2013 from the Chicago Jazz Revealed show that we used to do at Katarina's right there in Chicago. On this show, we've got special guest bassist Frank Russell, incredible saxophonist Jeff Bradfield, and also vocalist Libby York. And stick around till the end because she performs a live tune for us on the podcast. So hope you like it. Let's get to it. Welcome to Chicago Jazz Revealed. I'm Mike Jeffers here on WDCB 90.9 FM. We are live from Katarina's here in Chicago. And we have a special preview, Chicago Jazz Festival preview show this week. Of course, the Chicago Jazz Fest is coming up August 29th through September 1st, and that's happening in Millennium Park in downtown Chicago. Of course, there's more details at WDCB.org and ChicagoJazz.com. I wanted to feature some of the artists that are going to be performing on the Chicago Jazz Festival. So this show, we're going to be featuring the great bassist Frank Russell, who has a new CD out called Circle Without End that's been hitting the charts and getting a lot of airplay throughout the country. Also on the show, Jeff Bradfield, saxophonist Jeff Bradfield, who will be doing a performance at Millennium Park on the main stage, the Prixter Pavilion, coming up this weekend for his Melba release. And he's going to have the great pianist Randy Weston performing along with him. So we're going to talk to Brad a little bit about that performance coming up and the creation of his recording Melba, which is on Origin Records. And also Libby York. Libby York is going to be performing in the Jazz Oasis, which is something that Chicago Jazz Magazine programs and produces down at the Jazz Fest, which is right in Millennium Park. So they moved the entire Chicago Jazz Festival this year from Grant Park over to the Millennium Park. I guess you'd call it the Millennium Park Gardens. You know, it's all around the entire area they're taking over. And they're not going to lose any stages this year. Basically, what they're going to do is they're going to be setting up the old Jackson Street stage in another location on the Millennium Park grounds. They're going to have the Jazz and Heritage stage in another section. They're going to have the Young Lions performance area where they feature high school jazz bands from throughout the entire Chicagoland area on another space. I believe that's going to be up on the Harris Theater, near the Harris Theater area. And then the Chicago Jazz Magazine Jazz Oasis, which we started producing 3 years ago with a lot of help from the city of Chicago and, of course, the Chicago Jazz Institute, which programs the Jazz Festival. And with the Jazz Oasis, we actually are able to feature all Chicago, local Chicago jazz artists, so in an intimate setting. It's a nice intimate setting, and I believe this year's Jazz Oasis is going to be located very close to the Bean, so it'll be easy to find. Of course, we're going to have a map and lots of different information available at ChicagoJazz.com. So we're going to feature the artists this week. Of course, also Libby York will be performing live on the show today with pianist Jeremy Kahn. So before we get to all of that, I wanted to feature a local artist, speaking of local artists, by the name of Nicole Kessler. And this is off of her release. She performs here at Katarina's on a regular basis. Wanted to feature something off of her latest release, High Standards, and this is a high standard. This is one of my favorite songs by the great Hoagy Carmichael, Johnny Mercer, Skylark, here on Chicago Jazz Revealed, WDCB 90.9 FM. We're live at Katarina's. I'm Mike Jeffers, and it's a pleasure to have Mr. Frank Russell, great bass player, and of course we just heard Code M show charting all over the country. And I know you've gotten a lot of inquiries about playing festivals and everything else of this.
Yeah. First of all, it's great to be here. I heard your maiden voyage with Dee Alexander, and it was a wonderful show. Dee actually was in a band with Ken Chaney with me.
Oh, no kidding.
The late, great pianist Ken Chaney, who I worked with for 30 years, and Dee was in the band for 10 years. So we got a... She's like my sister.
But it had to be quite a band.
It was a great band. It was a great band. But speaking of the CD, yes, man, it's been a big blessing. I just wanted to do some music that I wrote, and some of my friends, I got to ask them if they would like to contribute. And Daryl Jones, who plays bass with Miles Davis, and of course plays with the Rolling Stones now, he gave me a tune that he wrote for Miles when Miles passed, and he never got to record this tune.
Oh, yeah.
So he asked, did I need any tunes? I said, sure, man, if you get. And so I got Daryl Jones, Wallace Rooney, a lot of Miles Davis alumni on the record who really helped me out. Bobby Irving, of course, is a great friend of mine. He actually helped me do a tune called Noble Street 5. And I got Henry Johnson, Mike Logan, Robert Gates, Kahari Parker, a plethora of great Chicago musicians.
Yeah, you have a lot of musicians on this CD.
Yeah, Richard Patterson, the bass player that plays with David Sanborn. He's the reason I got the gig with Ken Chaney. So 30 years ago, man.
Yeah.
Knock on wood. What a blessing that was.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how you got started, because you know, I know you because I actually played with you a couple of times at different gigs here and there. And what struck me was the way you use the bass as a lead instrument. I mean, you can groove and everything, you fall back into the ensemble, but you use that bass as a lead instrument. Who were some of your influences when you were coming up?
You know what? I think that stems from me starting to play guitar first.
Oh, okay.
I got a guitar.
Started on guitar.
I started on guitar and drums.
Very smart
before
man.
man. It enabled me to get some kind of my own voice. But you know what? I found a lot of great bass players that did start on drums, that play drums or guitar. But I saw the Beatles, man, like millions of others.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard all the girls screaming. but there was the music that really got me. And I asked my dad, would he get me a guitar? And I didn't know the difference between a guitar and a bass then.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually got me one. I was 7 years old. And I started getting lessons at 8.
Oh, wow. So you started early.
I started early, man. Yeah. And then I switched to bass guitar at the age of 14. I had a girlfriend in high school. She was in a band. She was a singer. Their bass player left the group. She asked, did I play bass? And she didn't know the difference. I said, sure. You know, she saw I had a guitar. What's the difference? So my dad got me a bass. I remember it was a Fender Mustang, which was a great bass to start off with at the age of 14. And I've been playing ever since. And she went on to become Emmy award-winning writer for General Hospital and All My Children and a bunch of different. Her name was Charlotte Gibson.
No kidding.
So thanks, Charlotte, for switching me to bass, because I'm so glad I stopped playing guitar, man, because you got Henry Johnson and guys Bobby Broom. And
I was going to say, you know, there's so much competition on guitar. I mean, there's a lot of great bass players, but it just seems like there aren't as many great bass players as there are, you know, other instruments. Yeah. Why do you think that is? It's just you just grab it. You just has to be ingrained in your body, you think?
I think so. You know, like you said, I played a bass like as a solo instrument. On some of the tracks, you hear I'm playing a five-string Lakeland, who I endorse, by the way. I'm a clinician for them. They send me all around the country. And I tune the bass with a high C sometimes. So some people think it's a guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually have to tell them, no, that's me. They said, man, I like the guitar player on there. I said, that's me.
That's you.
Know, I have to tell people. Because people don't really know the difference, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of laymen. But it's just a wonderful thing, man. I'm so happy with the direction I took.
Well, you know, as you're growing up, you know, what were some of the gigs? I mean, well, I guess, you know, you're playing at 14. You're in high school. You're probably playing rock. You're doing all the different things like that.
A lot of Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Yeah, yeah.
Larry Graham.
So how did you take that and all of a sudden go into the jazz area too?
You know what? I had friends early on. In my teen years, Henry Johnson I met.
Okay,
when
so
I was
you've
15.
Known you've known him for a long time.
And Henry
now,
was he was in the West Montgomery way back then.
Really?
And I didn't actually play with him. He used to come pick up a drummer named Hezekiah Williams at a rehearsal I was at. So I kind of started gravitating towards the musicians that played this music that I was kind of grew up with. My dad played a lot of Miles Davis around the house growing up and Coltrane and. And I said, man, I need to gravitate towards those musicians that can really play stuff besides this funk and rock, and which I think you need that to go to this to the more progressive music. So I started hanging out with Henry Johnson, Billy Foster, a great pianist from Chicago, and I used to go see L.D. Young when I was a teenager.
Sure, yeah.
And he encouraged me. I said, L.D., I want to grow up and be a bass player. And I actually saw his sons at Ken Chaney's memorial service that I kind of put together, the music for it. And I played Amazing Grace, and they came to me in tears. And I said, that was for your dad, too, man.
Yeah.
And so it's just a beautiful
thing.
Well,
and LD had to be quite the influence on you.
Yeah,
I mean,
man.
Not only his playing, but, I mean, his personality. He seemed so giving.
He was. He encouraged me. He said, you can be whatever you want to be. If you want to be a professional bass player, that's what you – so I kind of owe a lot to LD.
Yeah. Now, you gravitated toward the electric. Did you ever do upright? Do you play upright?
You know what? My dad played upright, and of course I could get on it and play, but I kind of just wanted to be not a jack of all trades and a master of none.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I see a lot of cats try to do both, and it kind of suffers. So I kind of stuck with that, with the electric bass. Of course I play fretless, and with playing with Ken Chaney so many years, 30 years, I was able to make the bass electric sound like an upright.
Okay.
One of my greatest stories is I recorded with Henry Johnson, and Freddie Hubbard was on the CD. And we did the music before we got it to Freddie. He sent the music to Freddie. I'm on Fender bass. He said, "Who's on upright?" And Henry said, "No, that's an electric bass." Freddie got indignant. I know what a guy. So they had to isolate the track so he could hear the fret noise.
Oh, really?
And it got back to me that Freddie Hubbard thought I was playing upright. So that's one of my.
That's a good compliment,
isn't that a
right
great
there.
Compliment? So I hear that in my playing with Ken Chaney, and a lot of these guys around town, Ari Brown, these great jazz guys, Willie Pickens, they all call me to play electric bass. It's about the music and about my feel and the sound, not just the electric, the upright bass. They call me for my playing ability and my sound. So I always thank them for that.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that, obviously you've mastered the feel, but do you think that there's a real distinct advantage for younger kids or younger bass players coming in to play upright just to get a feel happening?
Sure.
Or do you think you can do it on either one? It's just a matter of how you conceptualize it.
My journey was my own. I think everybody has to find their own journey. I would never tell a guy to not play upright, because if you get prolific or proficient on both, you can get more gigs.
Right, right.
So I'm so glad I stuck to my guns and I've subsequently been put in books, one by John Liebman with some of the top bass players in the world, with Stanley Clarke, Marcus Miller, Daryl Jones, Louis Johnson, Larry Graham, and
Frank Russell.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
The guy called me up and asked me would I like to be in the book. I said, let me think. Yes.
That was a
it's called Funk Bass by John Liebman. It's the 25th anniversary came out.
Okay.
Last year. So.
So now as you're going through, you're coming up, you're playing gigs. I mean, when did you start kind of gravitating? Well, I shouldn't say gravitating. When did you start like getting those gigs that started really kind of pushing you up the ladder of stature here in Chicago?
Getting the gig with Ken Chaney.
What was that like? I mean, I know Ken just from he was playing either jobbing stuff, he was playing jazz clubs, he was backing singers, he was doing everything.
He was doing everything, and Ken never frowned he wanted to play all kinds of music, like the late great George Duke played funk, played jazz. You might want to do some weather report. Ken did everything, and this it kind of set my goal to try to emulate Ken, and he was such a great leader, and he never got in the band's way. What you do, what Ken did, was get the best players he could get, and let them be themselves.
Yeah.
He never told me what to play in 30 years, man.
Really?
No, it's unbelievable. He may have said he gave me charts and stuff, but he just let me play, man. He just let me play. So.
So that really kind of probably really
submitted,
allowed you to experiment
and
figure things out.
Henry Johnson's the same way. Only thing Henry he challenged you every time you played with him.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to hear some different stuff. He wanted to hear what you were working on. And it got kind of frustrating sometimes back then.
Right.
But now that I think about it, it really allowed me to grow and to be the solo artist I am now. Henry never, and he's still growing, man. He's one of the most prolific guitar players in the world. I mean, when George Benson comes to town, he calls Henry up, and we go hang out.
Yeah, yeah.
And to sit those two, another reason I'm glad I quit guitar.
Yeah.
Seeing those two sit across from each other, close as you and I are.
Yeah.
It's a mind-boggling thing, man. And the whole time, I'm like, I'm so glad I switched.
So you've played with all of these different people. Now, mm-hmm. I know that you have a track on the new CD called Ladysmith,
yeah.
Blackman's Mambazo.
Oh, man, yeah.
And you played with them for 6 years, you were telling
me.
Yeah,
I toured with those guys. I did a play at the Steppenwolf Theater, and it was a polka play, as a matter of fact, and... The director, Eric Simonson, he called me up one day. He came out to see me play somewhere. And he said, Frank, would you be interested in doing another play with me? And this time I'll have Ladysmith Black Mambazo. And once again, I said, let me think about it. Yes.
Yeah, right, yeah.
So the funny thing is, who's the bass player that played with Ahmad Jamal for years?
Oh.
Kamak? James Kamak.
James, yeah.
He was supposed to do the Steppenwolf gig, but he got a gig with Nancy Wilson. For 4 months, I believe.
Okay.
So he gave me the gig for 2 months. But then it turned into 6 years. So every time he sees me, he's like, I said, thanks so much, man, because it allowed me to play with one of the most prolific South African groups of all time, you know.
Oh, yeah.
From that Graceland album. And you'll like this, Jeff. I played drums on that gig, too.
Oh, you played drums, too?
Drums and bass.
African
and
drums, or...
I played the big, what's the big,
I don't know. I haven't been in African drum.
Yeah, it's a big, big sucker. I had to stop playing that because my arms started turning into Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
But I've actually played drum traps on that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to get double scale. So I always, that was a great
Now, was this a show that...
A show that traveled.
Traveled
yeah.
and stuff so that you'd be in a city for a month here,
yeah,
a month there, 3 months, 3 weeks?
3 months. We did the Kennedy Center.
Oh, wow.
Steppenwolf Theater. We broke a box office attendance records.
Wow.
Boston, Huntington Theater. We went all over the place.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a listen to the track. It's called Ladysmith Black Mambazo.
Mm-hmm.
And that's off of your new CD, Circle Without End. It's Frank Russell, and this is Chicago Jazz Revealed on WDCB 90.9 FM and ChicagoJazz.com. We'll be right back. All right, we're back here at Chicago Jazz Reveal live at Katarina's, 1920 West Irving Park Road here in Chicago. I'm Mike Jeffers, publisher of Chicago Jazz Magazine, and we are here with bassist Frank Russell. We just heard the tune Ladysmith, Black Mambazo. I don't know why I keep saying it the other way, but it's because I wrote it down wrong probably on my sheet. But I got it right that time, and that's off of his recording, Circle Without End. Now, you were telling me you were playing a few different parts on this.
Yeah, all the parts are done on bass and except percussion. So there's like five different bass parts on there. And I'm singing. I'm doing all the vocals.
Oh.
And I actually played it for Ladysmith when they were here at Old Town, and they loved it.
They
started doing the dance. They're dancing. We all start doing the gumboots dance. And I wanted them to sing on it. But that's like trying to get GM to sing.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
So I said, well, let me try it. I was around them enough. And lost my train of thought there.
That's all right.
Okay?
That's because we have a live audience here.
Okay.
That's what we want. You guys can talk and clap. just don't fall down.
Okay. Anyway.
Live at Katarina's. You never know what's going to happen here. So anyway, so you were talking. You saw them down there, and it was like.
Yeah. Every time when they come into town, we usually go hang out.
Okay.
And my wife and I and you know, it's been since 96 since I actually worked with them. But I feel like part of the family. They started calling me Frank Shabalala.
Is it pretty much the same guys from?
Well, not from the original.
Okay.
Not from the Paul Simon Graceland. I think there's about four original guys left. Of course, Joseph Shabalala, he's the leader. His sons have kind of taken a lead in the band now.
Okay.
And
so they're
got
keeping
three
it
songs.
In the family.
They're keeping it in the family, man. And it's just one of the best gigs I've ever been on.
It had
man.
To be an incredible experience.
Oh my God, those guys! Just to sit in a room with them as they sang those parts, and I was the only American musician. In the play, yeah.
Yeah.
And they had a concertina player. And a guitar player who tuned the guitar. I don't know how. I could never get a note out of that thing. But we just communicated. We just communicated through music, man. And I looked up all kinds of South African music to before I got with them because I was nervous. I said, well, I don't know what these guys want. So, and when I got with them, they said, Frank, we want you to just play like you. I said, well, I could do that.
Yeah, right.
So it's a great, great gig.
Well, you know, you went from doing something like that, and then we were talking about how you just did a tribute to Miles Davis a few months ago at Main Stage.
Yeah.
And I know you have a connection to some of the people that played with Miles Davis, including...
Yeah. Vince Wilburn is a great friend of mine. I've been knowing him for years. I actually met... he's Miles Davis' nephew, and he played drums with Miles for years.
Okay.
And he's one of the executors to the Miles Davis estate. He's a great friend of mine. And he gave me the idea about doing this, doing the CD in the first place. But the actual Miles concert, Lynn Orman Weiss, she's a producer around town.
Mm-hmm.
She came to me wanting to do something for Jazz Appreciation Month. And they wanted to do a tribute to Miles Davis. And she had heard my record. And since it sounded so much like Miles Electric Years, we decided to do Miles Davis tribute. The Electric Years at the Main Stage.
Okay.
And it was one of the best nights of my life.
That is a great venue, too, isn't it?
It's beautiful, man.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. The sound was gorgeous. I got to fly my mother and father in. And my dad was one of the biggest Miles Davis fans. So some of the early records I remember on the wall was Kind of Blue. And
oh, yeah.
And so it was like full circle bringing my dad in to see this concert. And he had been so sick a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
So we did the concert. It was sold out, standing room only, and it was one of the best nights of my life. We actually, through Vince Wilburn, he got Sony Music to give away some Miles Davis LPs, some reissues.
Oh, really?
So we gave some of those away to the patrons that came to the show, and I actually had Miles Davis' grandson and great-grandson in the audience.
Wow.
So it was a...
And they're active in the estate probably too, right?
Yeah. Well, their mother is. The Cheryl and Aaron Davis and Vince Wilburn are the executives to the Miles Davis estate. And it was a beautiful night to get the sanction from the family really made it a special night.
You think you're going to have anything like that coming up again?
You know what? That might be my.
That had to be a lot of work, right?
It was a lot of work, but you know what? It wasn't a lot of work because that's the music I kind of grew up on.
Right.
I just found the best tunes that I liked. I'm not going to do any more Miles tributes, but there's talk of me doing other tributes to like maybe Herbie.
Sure.
Or Weather Report.
Sure, yeah.
I could do it like a tribute. What was that group's name?
Tributosaurus.
Tributosaurus for electric jazz.
Yeah, right.
So
yeah, there's nobody doing it. You just got to come up with a catchy name. Tributosaurus.
A bassinosaurus. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, now you have some gigs coming up mm-hmm. That we want to make sure we talk about because that's why we're. I mentioned at the top of the show that we're the three people that are on this show today are all going to be playing on the Chicago Jazz Festival.
Oh, great.
Coming up on Labor Day weekend. And but first, you have a Jazz Fest coming up. You're going to be in Woodstock at the Woodstock Jazz Fest. You're headlining August 23rd.
Yeah. Billy Dink, who puts these on, I think this is his third year or something.
Mm-hmm.
He asked would my band play. He actually saw me at the Hyde Park Jazz Festival last year.
Okay.
And I said, of course, I would love to play. And so we'll be doing that Woodstock, Illinois. At you can probably look up their website, Woodstock Jazz Festival. I actually asked him, is this the Woodstock that Jimi Hendrix played on? He said, no, that's not.
It's a little farther east.
Yeah.
So you've got that one coming up. And then before we talk about the Chicago Jazz Festival, you're also going to be playing Hyde Park again.
Yeah,
Hyde
Park Jazz Festival, 2 years in a row.
September 28th at the Smart
at
Museum.
At the Smart Museum at 1 o'clock, 1 p.m. It's cool, man, because that's been it's the seventh year.
Seventh, I think,
and
so.
And it's gotten so huge, and I played it like five times out of 7 years.
Really?
Two times with my band, once with Henry Johnson, Ken Chaney, and somebody else I can't even think of. But it's five. Oh, Tony Carpenter. He had one of the first things, his group called Toca.
Okay. So you're going to be there now. Well, let's talk about the Chicago Jazz Fest as well, but then... So you're going to be at the Von Freeman Pavilion.
Yes,
August 31st.
That's a great honor to be on the. This will be the first time that they named the stage after him. And Von was I played with George Freeman, another guy. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be an honor to play on that stage, and we're really looking forward to it. I got some great guys. My keyboard player Greg Spiro, he actually moved to L.A. And so I'll have he won't be doing the festivals. I'll have the great Vijay Telesnayak playing.
Oh, great, sure.
And Tim McNamara, I know you know Timmy. Robert Gates on drums, and Dede Sampaio, who actually played with Miles on percussion. And Marco Valeria, great guitarist out of Indiana.
Now, are they going to be on all the festivals that you're doing?
The most part? Most of the festivals except Dede is not going to be on the Woodstock.
Okay.
No percussion on that one.
Okay. And like I mentioned at the top of the show, the Chicago Jazz Fest is August 29th through September 1st, but they moved it. It's going to not be in Grant Park this year. I want to make sure. I keep mentioning that because I know everybody's going to walk into Grant Park looking for it. It's up in Millennium Park, and they are using all the same stages. So basically the Jackson Street stage is what they've turned into the Von Freeman Pavilion.
Oh, really? Okay.
And... So that stage is going to be located, and I just got a map the other day from the city. It's going to be located fairly close to the main stage Prixter Pavilion. So everything's going to be up in the same area. And so you can obviously see Frank at the Chicago Jazz Fest, which is August 31st, noon to 12:55.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they can get more details at frankrussell.com.
FrankERussell.com.
FrankERussell.com.
Somebody had Frank Russell.
Well, let's find him. Well, let's close this out with one more tune from your latest release, your chart topping
CD. Yeah,
we're
so happy, man. We got airplay in like 15 different countries.
You got a lot of write ups too.
Including you guys. I want to thank you and Dan Healy.
Dan Healy.
He did a great write up. It was so great. People asked me, did I write it?
Well, you know, when I talked to him about it, he actually said, he goes, you know, I've been listening to this nonstop. Let me just write the review. I said, well, write the review.
Wow.
Let's go. So he really enjoyed it, and I think you get that when you read the review.
Yeah, I hope he comes out to see the band.
Well, let's do this. So we're going to hear quick picks.
Yeah.
And I know there's a story about that because there's it's you and Daryl Jones are on this recording, right?
And Richard Patterson.
And Richard Patterson.
Two of my favorite bass players who actually both play with Miles. Richard was the last bass player to play with Miles, and Daryl got the gig, and I forget what the year was, but we used to get together when they came into town and go into my apartment and play bass guitar to 2, 3, and 4 in
really?
The morning.
Yeah.
And I wrote a song that could be a vehicle for all three of us, where I would play the high part on bass, and Richard would do the slap part, and Daryl would play the melody with me, and it really came out so well, man. Anybody that liked that SWV, the Stanley Clark, Marcus Miller, Victor Wooten thing would love this song. And we're getting a lot of a lot of people from the bass world really love this tune. And actually, Daryl Jones would be playing the first solo, Richard Patterson the second solo, and I'm coming in on the end. So it's called Quick Picks, that I named after my brother. His name is, nickname is Picks.
Oh.
So yeah, and he plays bass out in Minneapolis for our heavy metal band.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, let's take a listen. Quick Picks here off of Frank's latest release, Circle Without End, live on Chicago Jazz Revealed, 90.9 FM, WDCB.
Thank you.
back here at Chicago Jazz Revealed, live at Katarina's. It's okay to applaud. It's all right. Woo. Yes. Thank you. Thank you. And we are here with saxophonist Jeff Bradfield, and we are going to be talking about a whole bunch of stuff. First off, congratulations on Melba, the release that you just came out with. When was that? That was earlier this year, right?
Yeah, it came out, I think, in late April, and we played the Green Mill for the release party shortly after that. We'd already toured it around a little bit in the fall before that, taking it down south to Knoxville, and put it in IU, and then it was on NPR on a show they do with Dede Bridgewater called The Jazz Set. So it kind of made the rounds before it came out.
Right. Well, that's the way to do it. That's how you sell copies, right?
Right. I hope so. We'll see about that.
But you're going to also be performing at the Chicago Jazz Festival.
We will be.
Coming up. And you're going to be playing with the great pianist Randy Weston as part of that performance. And you're going to be playing some tunes, I would assume, from Melba.
We will. In fact, we're hoping to play... sort of trying to work out the timing right now because the Melba piece is a suite that, you know, it could be an hour long if everybody really stretches out. But we try to mash that down and still play almost the whole thing. And then Randy's going to join us for the finale, and we're going to play something of his.
Oh, okay. All right. And that's going to happen August 30th, right on the main stage at the Prixter Pavilion.
That's right.
6:30. And, well, let's talk a little bit about Melba because I'm not sure how many of our listeners are actually familiar with who Melba was. It's Melba Liston.
Melba Liston, right.
And why don't you tell us a little bit about who she was?
Well, Melba Liston was a trombonist and an arranger. Great trombone player. You know, played with Dizzy Gillespie's band, led her own group later in her life, and sideman on many sessions. But she's probably better known as an arranger and composer, especially as an arranger working with Randy Weston, which is one of the reasons he's so perfect to join us for the Jazz Fest. And because she was an arranger and a composer and worked on so many sessions with so many different people, she just slipped a lot of people's notice. So, you know, sort of in the shadows.
One of those people that writes stuff, is there on the session contributing, but isn't, like, headlining.
Right, right. You know, like, I was looking through for a photo of her when the record was coming out. I was looking for a photo that hadn't been published, and I found some great photos of her at a Mary Lou Williams session. So you see in those kind of contexts what she's doing in the background. She's standing up, waving the music around. Everybody's listening to her. She's bent over the piano, fixing something on Mary Lou's part. Like, she's really controlling the music in a lot of the ways of the session. But when the record comes out, her name's in fine print on the back sleeve. You know, which on iTunes, you don't even see the back of the
record cover. Right, exactly. I didn't even think of that, but you're right. Yeah. On iTunes, it's like... you don't even know who that is.
Absolutely. So I felt like as I started to discover in my own research what she had done, I was certainly amazed that I'd remained ignorant of her for so long because she's worked with so many people. She came up – really, she was born in Kansas City. Then she moved to Los Angeles, and she spent kind of her formative teen years from middle school on there working with Gerald Wilson especially. Great big band leader, arranger, and composer. Yeah. And she learned from him the way a lot of old school writers did. She was with him in the early 1940s. And she learned from him by copying out parts.
Okay.
That was her job. You know, she's a copyist for him. And so in the process of that, she learned how to write. She probably already, she says in an interview, that she already had that all together. But it's hard to imagine that at 17, she wouldn't have learned something copying out Gerald Wilson's part.
Right.
but in any case, with no formal jazz education or anything at that point, that's how a lot of older musicians learned how to write. You know, Benny Carter learned on Fletcher Henderson's band by copying out Don Redmond's charts. It was just one of the ways you could get inside that skill. So after that, after writing with Gerald, and, you know, together they toured with Ellington and Basie. She toured with his band. She drops out of music periodically. But during that time, she'd met Dizzy Gillespie, and she worked for his band in two different stints. And I've had too long a day at this rehearsal to remember the dates. But
we won't hold you to it. Don't worry.
1950s, I'll generalize. probably the most important series is around 1957. She wrote some music for Dizzy Gillespie at the Newport Festival that brought Mary Lou Williams out of retirement. And she also went on these jazz ambassador tours.
Okay.
That were sponsored by the U.S. State Department, famous for Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, and Dizzy Gillespie, Dave Brubeck, all sorts of folks doing those. And when I read this, too, it felt like a real connection to her, because I've done two of those tours. That program still exists.
Oh, okay.
And the last CD I put out, African Flowers, was inspired by one of those tours. So to read about Melba in the Middle East trying to arrange a national anthem of some country they're visiting for Dizzy Gillespie's band and play, I was like, oh, we did that in Russia. Or, you know, like, it just,
wow,
just struck,
yeah,
a familiar chord. Which
Well, there's like that synergy. I mean, how weird is that, right?
Yeah,
I mean, that you were doing the same stuff as what she was doing.
Absolutely bizarre. And then to read about Randy Weston in his autobiography, writes about traveling to Africa for the first time. And, you know, a couple of years before I read that, I'd been to Africa for the first time. And, you know, my impressions were not his, certainly, because he grew up in a very different environment. In,
sure,
Brooklyn with his dad as a follower of Haile Selassie and a real serious Africanist.
Mm-hmm.
But still, that's an amazing feeling, visiting a place that's kind of legendary,
yeah,
like that, especially as a jazz musician that has this deep mythology to it. So reading Randy's reactions to being there for the first time, you know, you feel this, I felt this empathy for what he was feeling.
Well, you know, and I mean, just start right at the beginning. How did you even think to even start researching Melba Liston? Because you didn't know who she was,
right,
until
you
started, really, did you?
I did know who she was. But only in her connection with Randy Weston.
Okay.
Because I had been a fan of his for a long time. And probably when I was, you know, in school in like 1991 or 1992, Spirits of Our Ancestors came out. Great Randy Weston 2-CD set.
Yeah.
With,
yeah,
Dizzy Gillespie on it. And I'd never heard of Randy up to that point, but I knew who Dizzy Gillespie was. And some local critic, honestly, I think it was Lloyd Sachs, walked in the CD store, and I kind of knew him,
mm-hmm,
for, you know.
Sure.
From just hanging out in the store, and he said, oh, you got to check this out. You got to check Randy Weston. I said, all right, so got the CD. Loved it because, you know, not only is it Randy Weston with Dizzy Gillespie, Melba Liston's hip arrangements, but he's got three great tenor players on it. He's got Billy Harper and Farrell Sanders and Dewey Redman, and two of those guys are Texas tenor players. I'm from Houston.
Oh, well, there you go.
So, yeah, it's, what's not to love, right? You know, Billy Harper and Dewey Redman were already two of my favorites. So,
mm-hmm,
so that just resonated right away. And then I followed Randy's career after that, and Melba always did the arrangements for those groups.
Okay.
You know, back to his first record on United Artists, I think, called Little Niles, a record of all waltzes with children's, dedicated to children.
Okay.
Beautiful record. So I was aware of her in that context, but what I didn't know was the stuff with Gerald Wilson, Dizzy Gillespie, Milt Jackson, Clark Terry, and then moving out of the jazz world, she wrote for Motown, especially after they were in Los Angeles, I want to say, once Motown moved to Los Angeles. But she may have been writing for them when they were in Detroit as well. I'm not sure exactly how those dates overlap. She supposedly wrote for Marvin Gaye. You know, then she moved,
wow,
to Jamaica, and she wrote for reggae artists there and did a score to, like, sort of the first Jamaican comedy. Or one of the
comedy.
First Jamaican. Yeah,
yeah.
It's a film called Smile Orange.
Okay.
Hard to find. You can find it on Netflix. Like, you can't everything now, right?
But, right, right.
But,
you'd,
yeah,
have to look
hard
for
to find
it, though.
For
I'm
years.
Sure
you
you'd have to be looking
down.
For it. Trust,
yeah,
me.
Yeah.
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 Well, that's amazing that she would be all over the place like that. I mean, you know, you think of... oh, my gosh, I'm drawing a blank. Who's the famous...
Like Nelson Riddle. You're thinking of Arranger?
No, yeah, Arranger. Oh,
like,
man.
Strayhorn. And
Quincy.
Oh, Quincy Jones. Yeah.
You know,
I
you
mean,
think of Quincy
she's
Jones.
She's almost like a...
Right. That's what it sounds,
yeah,
like.
Yeah, absolutely. Able to write in all sorts of different styles to please different music. And she talks about that, and Randy talked about that. Yeah, I'd met him a few times in the last couple of years since I started working on this. And when I was in New York recently... We had the rough mixes of the CD done, and I told him I'd give him a call,
mm-hmm,
to send it to him. And I thought, you know, he's a busy guy, and he's in his 80s, and probably doesn't really have time to listen to this.
Right.
And so I call him, but I called him, and I was in New York doing the interview for the NPR show. And I get a call back later in the day, and it's Randy Jeff, Randy Weston. Why don't you come over tomorrow?
Like,
all right.
Wow.
So, yeah, I found myself on a train early in the morning going to Randy Weston's house down, and I guess he's in Brooklyn, I think in Bedford-Stuyvesant. House that is he grew up in with his dad, or really the second house, but
yeah,
they're kind of neither here nor there. And we talked for a couple hours, and he was generous enough to allow me to record our conversation. And I asked him that about how Melba wrote for so many different people. And he told me a couple things, one of which was that she had this special talent for getting inside somebody else's music and writing seamlessly with whatever was already there.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said that when she wrote for him, she would bring music that he hadn't written to the session, parts that he hadn't written, sections of pieces. And he said that it wasn't what he gave her, but it was his.
Yeah.
That she wrote so well in his voice that it felt completely natural to him. It sounded like, oh, yeah, I would have done that. Yeah, which is why she could turn around and write for Marvin Gaye,
yeah,
and turn around and write for Diana Ross and whoever else she worked for over the years. Gloria Lynn. Big.
Well, let's take a listen to a track, why don't
great.
We? I mean,
great.
Now I know all about Melba Liston, so let's hear something here. So this is off Jeff Bradfield's recording, Melba, and then we're going to listen to Central Avenue. What's that?
Yeah, so Central Avenue is my attempt to capture sort of the mood of that really second period of life that I'm talking about. So she grew up in Kansas City, and then mm-hmm. as a teenager, she moves to Los Angeles. And the hip jazz scene at the time is on Central Avenue. That's the hopping street. It's like 52nd Street in New York, or I don't know, maybe the south side of Chicago and
sure.
certain areas around the same time. And, you know, she's going out to jam sessions. She goes to middle school with Dexter Gordon. She's hanging out with all the cats. So it's sort of a jam session kind of tune. It's a blues. Everybody plays a little bit on it. Sort of a blues. I shouldn't say it's exactly a
right.
blues. You'll get some callers complain. It's sort of a blues. So features everybody in the band.
Puts
just a little bit.
Puts the disclaimer in.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And then at the end, in kind of a Mingus-y California vibe, swings out with Joel Adams blowing on the trombone.
Nice. All right, well, let's take a listen to that here on Chicago Jazz Revealed on 90.9 FM and chicagojazz.com.
Thank you.
Okay, we're back here at live at Katarina's. It is Chicago Jazz Revealed. We are here live at Katarina's. There are people eating and drinking and hanging out. They're getting ready for Libby York and Jeremy Connell be performing later on tonight. We're at 1920 West Irving Park Road, but we are still here a few more minutes with Jeff Bradfield. And we just heard that song, Central Park, off of Melba, his latest recording.
Central Avenue.
Central Avenue, but it came off the album Melba.
Yes,
so we,
exactly.
We heard that. And where can people find this, Jeff? Is there more information at your website?
Yeah, you can find it at jeffbradfield.com. You can go to the record label's website, Origin Records.
Mm-hmm.
You can also find it on Amazon, iTunes, the Jazz Record Mart. If you live in Chicago, you should buy it at the Jazz Record Mart. They're good people. They keep
right.
A real record store where you can thumb through the bins.
Bob Kester,
yeah.
My main man.
Yeah.
My main man. Well, let's talk a little bit more about Melba. Now, you wrote all of these tunes. Obviously, you composed all of them.
Right.
And you composed them kind of thinking like Melba would
yeah.
have? Or is this kind of your twist on what you think that she would have been?
Well, it's held together in two ways. One way is that it sort of traces the path of what I picked out as significant events in her life that
mm-hmm.
are mostly tied to places or people. So, for instance, the first one's Kansas City Child, and it's a spiritual that's supposed to symbolize her growing up to the age 11 or so in Kansas, learning how to play the trombone. But more than that, it doesn't have this childlike feeling to it. It has more of a spiritual feeling because she talks about listening to Ellington on the radio,
mm-hmm.
about sitting on the back porch with her grandfather playing the trombone, and she talks about playing a couple spirituals on the instrument.
Okay.
So I tried to write something that I thought could sound like a spiritual from that period.
Oh, okay, sure.
And then I actually wrote it from some lyrics from a poem by Georgia Douglas Johnson, and then it reappears at the very end. Great singer from Chicago, Maggie Burrell, sings it in just a very, very short version
mm-hmm.
under its original title as a poem, Let Me Not Lose My Dream.
Okay.
So anyway, that's the first and the last movements. Then in between, it moves on to Central Avenue, which you heard earlier,
mm-hmm.
which is her formative time in Los Angeles, apprenticing with Gerald Wilson, touring with Ellington and Basie, working in pit orchestras, going to jam sessions, kind
yeah.
of hopping lively tune. The third one, Dizzy Gillespie, is to me the next real pinnacle moment in her career,
mm-hmm.
because there she's working with one of the masters, and she's getting some of the recognition that she really deserves at this point, writing music for the band, touring with a band full of stars. You know, a
right.
fantastic band. Wynton Kelly on piano, and her,
oh, wow.
I mean,
yeah.
Benny Golson on tenor, Al Gray sitting next to her on trombone. One of the great bands of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And also, she's traveling internationally, I believe, for the first time with that band on the Jazz Ambassadors program that
okay.
I mentioned before. And they go to South America. So I try to capture some of Dizzy's South American thing in this, but also some of that gentle side of Dizzy Gillespie's thing,
yeah.
The way he could really kind of wear his heart on his sleeve on a ballad.
Mm-hmm.
And Victor, I think, does a beautiful job of that. The next movement moves on to her relationship with Randy Weston, which really spans the late 50s through 1999 when she died, through the end of her life. It's one of the longest collaborative relationships between any two musicians. You could compare it to Ellington and Strayhorn, I think. It's hard to think of anybody else who worked together and produced so many major pieces over four decades.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it moves from there to a period that I think of as sort of a interlude in Melba's life, where she's writing for Motown
mm-hmm.
in the late 60s, early 70s. And then she moves to Jamaica for about 7 years and vanishes from the scene. But she is working there. She's working with kids in the schools in Kingston. There's some great photos of her online conducting a choir or a band of Jamaican kids, and she's writing music for reggae musicians there.
Yeah, wow.
You know, and then the last really movement of the suite before that little coda that I mentioned earlier with Maggie,
mm-hmm.
it's called Homecoming. Because in, I want to say, late 1970s, she comes back to Kansas City to headline the first Women's Jazz Festival in Kansas City with her own band. So she comes back as a leader. So that's kind of the arc of her life. So that's a really long way of saying there's a narrative structure to it that holds it together. Now, the other thing is that I spent about a month in the archives at the Center for Black Music Research, where
mm-hmm.
all their scores are housed. And I picked out pieces from each period little chunks of music that she wrote that I thought were characteristic of hers.
Yeah.
Her style. And each movement's based on one of those.
Oh, that's really interesting, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm using some of her music directly.
Sure.
Stealing outright music.
All right. You heard it here first.
That's right. Steal from the wealthy, as they say.
And that's what this is about. Chicago Jazz Revealed just revealed that Jeff. No, I'm just kidding.
Totally.
Well, I'll tell you what. Why don't we play one more tune off of this? And, of course, everybody can see you performing this live August 30th, Millennium Park at the Chicago Jazz Fest on the main stage at the Prixter Pavilion, 6:30. You can get more details about everything at jeffbradfield.com.
Yep.
And why don't we hear one more tune? And we're going to hear the tune Randy Weston. Off of Melba. And thanks again for coming in.
Terrific. It was my pleasure. Thank you.
We'll be right back after this on Chicago Jazz Revealed, 90.9 FM, WDCB, and ChicagoJazz.com. All right, we're back here at Chicago Jazz Reveal, live at Katarina's. 1920 West Irving Park Road, and we record here live every Tuesday night, so if you'd like to be in the audience, there's more details at katarinas.com or on wdcb.org. And we have our special guest here, Libby York, is going to be performing live here tonight after the show, but she's also going to be doing... Yay. It's all right to clap. That's right. It's okay to clap and scream. It's all right to clap and scream. She's going to be performing live here after the show for the after sets as well. So, Libby, how are you?
I'm good. Nice to be with you, Mike.
I'm glad you were open tonight to come in. I know you've been traveling all over the place and performing everywhere. Now, you live here in Chicago sometime of the year, then you're in Key West sometime of the year, and then you're also back and forth to New York a lot, too,
right? That's right. I'm kind of in the gypsy phase of my life, I think, which is great. I love it.
But you were originally from Chicago.
Born and raised in Chicago. The cheering you heard in the background was the Sullivan High School friends that showed up. So, yeah, I was went to school here and... But went east to college and then lived on the East Coast for a long time.
Now, when did you start thinking about becoming a vocalist? Was it here in Chicago or was it when you went out to the East Coast in college?
Yeah, actually on the East Coast, I started singing in New York, just met a guitar player and started singing with him, and it kind of took. And I feel very blessed to have found something I love doing.
So when you first started out... who were some of your influences? I mean, somebody must have influenced, you must have heard
yes.
somebody and said, you know, I want to do that.
It's funny, I've told Frank Derone this, but when I was in high school at Sullivan, I had his first record, Joey Joey.
Oh, yeah.
And listened to Frank Derone, listened to June Christie,
mm-hmm.
and from there, and Oscar Brown Jr.,
It's a wide range.
And, you know, I was also listening to rock and roll and stuff, but I think Frank Derone, Oscar Brown Jr., and June Christie got me going on this music.
So did you just listen and you just learned how to sing from listening, or did you take some formal training? Did you study with anybody?
After the fact, I really learned in the beginning on the bandstand and was performing before I realized, okay, if I'm going to be singing several nights a week, I need to go back and really learn how to use my voice and, you know, lots of music theory and things that I really hadn't done. Then I backtracked and did some.
Did you go to college or did you just take private
lessons?
Yeah, I went
to American University in Washington, D.C. I was a political science major, so
they
really
work
good
on,
training
they work on music
for the real
charts
world.
All the time, yeah.
it was after college that I started singing.
So you get out of college. And where are you? You're in Washington?
In D.C., yeah.
In D.C. And you started sitting in. You started playing gigs. How did that whole thing come about? I mean, obviously, you know, when people think of you, as an accomplished jazz vocalist who, you know, has a deep knowledge of the American songbook, the jazz standards, everything else. There must have been something, because you were growing up and there was rock and roll happening. There was all these different things. I mean, you must have said to yourself, you know what, I'm going to really do this because you're not... Because you heard Frank Derone, I would imagine,
right.
It's because you had a love for something.
Well, it's funny. I was just Neil Tesser's sitting here in the back. Mm-hmm. I was just telling him my dad wrote a column for the Northwestern paper in the late 30s when all the big bands were coming through town, and they played that music around the house all the time.
Okay.
I mean, I heard a lot of Sinatra, Peggy Lee, you know, Carmen McRae. I heard it all as a kid. And thank goodness those lyrics have stuck in my brain all these years. So it's funny, you know, when you're a kid, you just think that's normal and everyone's life is like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I suppose early on that really was a big influence, just having my parents revere this music and think the singers were great and the big bands were great.
And as you're listening to stuff, I mean, you know, what I notice the most about vocalists, I mean, there's vocalists that know the words, and then there's vocalists that actually swing and make it musical and act like they're part of the band, their instrument, you know. I mean, their voice is an instrument. What were some of the influences? I mean, just phrasing-wise, and to get into the pocket and be able to swing. I mean, did you consciously do that, or do you think that it was just because you listened to so much stuff, it just got ingrained into your system, so that came out naturally?
Yeah, interesting question. You know, I've been doing it a while now, so every gig you pick up something new. But you know, it's so interesting to me. The lyrics, first of all, are, you know, so deep and so beautiful to so many of these songs. And then, yeah, the rhythm, you know, if you can swing them. A lot of mm-hmm. these songs were written as Broadway show tunes, and yet they swing like crazy, you right. know, if you have the right people to play with them. And so that's probably the two. Of course, a gorgeous melody doesn't hurt either.
I mean, who would have ever thought, like, Surrey with a Fringe on Top would actually swing?
Yeah,
right?
Right.
When they were writing it for the musical.
A lot of tunes. One of my favorites I'm doing right now is written by Leonard Bernstein and Comden and Green from the show Wonderful Town, 1953 show. It's Love. Mm-hmm. And it's in the show, it's a ballad, you know, but it swings, you know, yeah. and it's so interesting to me that so many of the songs can really adapt themselves to so many different rhythms. And if it's something like Leonard Bernstein, who I actually had the chance to sing with once.
Really?
At a party down in Key West, a dinner party. We were all drinking grappa, as I recall. Lenny knew I was a singer. Lenny, I'm familiar.
Lenny, yeah.
And he said, come on, Libby, let's go to the piano and play some blues. And, you know, it wasn't until later that I thought, oh, my Lord, I just sang the blues with Leonard Bernstein.
I think we need to delve more into the drinking in Key West and get more stories here. This is getting interesting now.
I have to say, you meet people down there that you might not otherwise meet. So,
well, what's your relationship to go to Key West? What I mean, you're in Chicago, you're out on the East Coast, and then I know you came back to Chicago. You were performing around Chicago, and now you have half the year. I think you're in Key West, right?
Is it just part because of the year gigs down there. Well, I got a place down there years ago when it was still fairly possible to buy in,
yeah.
and I've hung on to it. So. It's a wonderful spot to kind of recharge and, you know, get out of the Chicago winter or the
yeah.
New York winter. You can't beat it.
But what's the music scene like? I mean, I know there's a lot of people that come. I mean, you just told me that you were hanging out with Lenny Bernstein. So, I mean, who's down there and how, you know, connection-wise, who are you talking to? Who are you playing with? Is there a lot of work down
well,
there?
Well, actually, Jeremy Kahn came down and played a concert with me last year, and we played in the Truman Little White House in Harry Truman's living room.
Okay.
The Trumans had a place there, and it's, you know, run as a museum, but they mm-hmm. also do concerts and clear out the living room, put little cabaret tables in, and Jeremy played Harry's piano. That was very cool. So a few special events like that. I have to say there's not as much of a real jazz scene as there at one time was, so mm-hmm. it's more of a retreat rather than a place to really make a career.
Well, and then also you're in Chicago, and then you go to New York a lot, too.
I have
And
been.
I know you have really deep connections with people out in New York, one of them being Russell Malone, who I think played on one of your other albums and one that's coming up, right?
Right, right.
How did you guys meet? How did that come about?
I lived in New York for 15 years, practically, and... yeah, on my last CD here with you, Russell Malone played with, and Howard Alden played, and Warren Vaché. And on this new release, which I'm very excited about, coming out early next year, Russell is playing, and wonderful pianist John DeMartino, and Warren Vaché on cornet, and also a couple of really fun vocal duets that we've done together. Martin Wind on bass and Chicago's own Greg Sergo on
yeah.
the drums. So I have a great band with me.
You know, in recent years, I mean, you just released, your Here With You recording, and you released a recording before that fairly, I mean, there wasn't a lot of time in between one recording to another recording, and now you have a new recording coming out early 2014. It's got to be a lot of work to put together these recording sessions, pick the music, pick the songs. How do you, conceptually, how do you go about doing that? Like, let's just say here with you, how did you come up with these specific tunes? Are these tunes that you're playing a lot, or are these tunes that, you know, are something meaningful to you?
Yeah, there. It's all interesting. There's actually been about 5 years between each recording. Seems to take me that long to, if you're producing.
Well, I just remember
your
this
own.
Like a couple of years ago coming out. So I guess if it's been 5 years, they're coming fast
five.
And furious to me too.
You know, it's interesting being the vocalist and also the producer. I've learned a lot about all of that. The new one is called Memoir, and it's quite personal. Has some songs that I grew up listening to around the house on my parents' 78s. I think each song that I record has some kind of personal meaning. It's very fascinating to me to watch a recording kind of become itself, you know, each step of the way. I've just gotten the master to the new one this last week, so it's going out to the people we're going to use for the radio promo and press and all of that. So now you get into the post-production PR part of it.
Right.
And that's a whole nother ballgame.
Well, you know, I mean, just talk a little bit about from the very beginning of it, right? I mean, you're sitting at home and you're deciding what tunes are going to be on there. And then it goes from that to getting the musicians, from that to getting the studio. I mean, everything is real personal because it's you.
Right.
So, I mean, how did you go about kind of picking the tunes that were on some of these? Well, let's just say here with you, picking the tunes, but I guess more specifically picking the tunes and picking the musicians, because obviously you're picking tunes with musicians in mind, I would imagine.
I mean, what I've found is that, you know, some of the greatest musicians in my book, since I've worked with them in New York or wherever, you know, everybody wants to work. So if you have a session and you can schedule it so that everybody's available, you can do it. That here with you, we did out at Bennett Studios, which was owned by Dave Bennett, Tony Bennett's son, and they had a great independent artist program. So that you could have this fabulous studio where Tony did all his Grammy winners for a rate that, you know, an independent artist could handle. It's a lot. It is. It's a lot. So each step, you just got to take it one step at a time. Of course, the music is the utmost, but and then getting these guys travel a lot and getting everybody's schedule so we can all get in the studio at the same time. And it's very interesting. I find it fascinating.
Well, now you're back in Chicago, and we know that you're going to be performing at the Jazz Oasis at the Chicago Jazz Fest, and I keep mentioning on the show that the Chicago Jazz Fest has moved up to Millennium Park this year. It's not in Grant Park, it's in Millennium Park, but they're still going to have the same great stages, same great programming, and actually it's starting a little bit earlier this year. It's starting on Thursday night, then Friday afternoon there's going to be music, and Friday night, and then all day Saturday and Sunday, of course. You're going to be performing at the Jazz Oasis on Sunday, September 1st, from 2 until 2:45. What other places are you performing, and where can people see you? Do you have anything else coming up here in Chicago or anywhere else?
Yeah, I'm going to be doing more things in Chicago as the new CD is released, so I would hope people can stay in touch on at LibbyYork.com or Facebook or Twitter. I did join the Twitter generation recently, Libby York Music, and here this month we're doing a concert at Fourth Presbyterian Church on the 23rd of August with Andy Brown on guitar, and that'll be fun. They have that beautiful outdoor courtyard and do a noon concert.
Right on Michigan Avenue, right?
Right on Michigan Avenue, right across from the Hancock Building. So I hope people will just check out my website. There's a page there with all of the dates on it.
Well, before you take off here, we're going to have you and Jeremy Kahn, great pianist from Chicago. You guys are going to play some tunes for us.
We are. I'm going to do a couple from from the new upcoming CD, and it'll be a pleasure.
Well, excellent. Well, thanks, Libby, and we'll be back. Libby's going to perform live here on Chicago Jazz Revealed, 90.9 FM and ChicagoJazz.com.